Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com.
Steven Mnuchin currently making comments saying that President Trump and Xi Jinping of China are likely to see each other at the end of June. He's also saying that he is happy to talk to Polaris chief executive officer on China trade policy. He made some comments about a potential U.S. default as well, saying that that could happen in late summer if there is no debt ceiling raise. He is testifying in front of Congress today and is going to be commenting. We'll bring you headlines as they appear. Meanwhile, the concept of the ongoing trade skirmish between the U.S. and China certainly has impacted tech shares, which have taken a beating and been much more volatile. Our next guest still likes a bunch of those tech stocks and perhaps is going to go shopping. Mark Baraboo. He is head of global equity at Jennison Associates, the fundamental equity and fixed income business of PGIM, overseeing about $160 billion from Boston. Mark, thank you so much for being here. So at this point, given how much we're seeing tech shares lag behind in light of some of the trade tensions, are you seeing opportunities?
Yeah, we definitely see opportunities. You know, our focus, of course, is on really strong secular growth stories in the market, and in technology, there are many. Oftentimes, they're not in the crosshairs of the trade war, so that, you know, it's not in semiconductors, it's not in devices. The areas we really like are cloud-based architectures, software as a service companies, digital payments globally, everywhere in the world, including in China. It's booming as everybody moves to more cashless systems. So there's lots of opportunities out there, but you really want to stick with the secular growers, not try to outsmart the markets on this trade war in the cyclical part of the market.
So, Mark, you mentioned kind of secular growth stories. One of the, you know, really interesting secular growth stories that has been developing within the tech space is just kind of the Chinese technology companies that have American investors have been able to invest in recently, Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu. What is your sense of those names given what appears to be rising trade tensions?
Yeah, well, let's look at Alibaba as an example because it's pretty clean in terms of the trade impact, because it doesn't really have any direct trade war impact. It's really just a domestically focused company solving for convenience for Chinese consumers and feeding that sort of emerging middle class boom that you're seeing in China. So, you know, for example, in the first quarter, they just reported 51% revenue growth. So no problems there. But their multiples come down now because of these trade tensions. So you could say that could be a really good opportunity because it's very inexpensive relative to its growth rate. And of course, a very, very profitable company because of their business model. So that would be a good one to focus on going forward. The only direct impact they would have is more indirect, and that would be a macroeconomic slowdown in China. Obviously, makes that more challenging for everybody. And I think that's what the market's pricing in, but it may be too pessimistic.
When we think about tech shares, we often think about the FANGs, and that's really sort of been the dominant player in this space. What about them? I mean, are you right now interested in Apple? Are you interested in Facebook? Are you interested in some of the big winners over the past couple months?
Well, I think, you know, looking at FANG and more broadly defined, you know, the market is maturing for some of those companies. So the smartphone market has matured globally. Search market is still growing nicely, but it's obviously slowing down on a structural basis just because it's so big. And so when you look at FANG today, I mean, the two that we're most excited about would be like a Netflix or Amazon, where the growth rates are still quite healthy. And there's a lot of market penetration left for both companies. So their addressable market keeps expanding, and that's what you'd want to look for. So I think even within FANG, the list gets narrower.
So, Mark, we would be remiss today if we didn't ask you your thoughts on Qualcomm. Big news this morning with their regulatory issues, stock down 10%. Give us your sense of Qualcomm.
Yeah, I think the market obviously thinks that recent deals that Qualcomm has negotiated with Apple and Samsung, for example, can somehow be broken. And you know, we're not legal experts, and we don't know all the details of their agreements. But it's our understanding that that's highly unlikely. And if that's the case, then Qualcomm's being oversold on this FTC decision because they've already privately negotiated agreements with their big customers, or most of them.
So I'm just wondering what your highest conviction bet is right now going forward over the next 6 to 12 months.
Well, we think it's in the area of digital payments, because all over the world, in developed markets, of course, we have good financial infrastructure, but we're still seeing consumers move and move away from cash, which is still amazingly a large percentage of transactions even here. And in emerging markets, they're actually leapfrogging to internet-based technologies that enable payments to occur very quickly with less fraud and very cheaply, and providing financial services to underbanked populations. So that's an area we think is just looks terrific.
And are you talking specifically about PayPal, about
Square?
I mean, are those the names you're talking
about?
Yes,
there's a whole list. In the U.S., it would be, of course, a company like MasterCard, which is benefiting from that digital transition. It would be PayPal with digital wallet. It would be Square with serving small businesses. But then when you move outside the United States, it's interesting companies like Mercado Libre in Latin America, which has a good chance of becoming a right. dominant digital payments provider in that region. It's already an e-commerce winner there. And of course, other companies that are just targeting payments like Adyen in the Netherlands, who have a blue chip customer list, including right. Netflix, Uber, Airbnb.
Interesting.
So it's very good.
It sounds like a hot sector. Mark Baribeau, head of global equity for Jennison Associates, the fundamental equity and fixed income business of PGIM.
Let's talk housing, because there have been signs that the slowing housing market is starting to turn around, at least in certain parts. The big question, though, is, especially here now that we've had the tax season, are we still seeing persistent weakness in some of the high tax states, particularly in the coastal areas? It's one area I'd like to focus on with Bess Friedman, Chief Executive Officer of Brown Harris Stevens, who joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studios. Bess, thank you so much for being here. So we look at the New York City market or the San Francisco market or some of these high-end coastal high-tax areas, are we seeing a substantial hit at an ongoing level from the removal of SALT deductions or have capping them anyway?
You know, I don't know. It's hard to say yet. We were just talking earlier about, you know, the new mansion tax, which has been enacted. And I think that come July, that goes into effect, and we won't know what the effect of that is going to be until we see the transactions from a year from now. So it's hard to say at this point.
But so I guess what I'm hearing in the New York market is that the higher end is weaker than, say, the mid end of the market. Is that true? And kind of what's driving that, if you think?
I think the high-end market has slowed down a bit, definitely the co-op market. I mean, that used to be booming, and we've definitely seen a slowdown. I think the prices were so uber high, you know, and you hear all these like big deals that got done, and those days are kind of, they've slowed down incredibly. So now people, the two-bedroom, the three-bedroom market, that market is very fluid, but the super high-end market, co-op market, has slowed down because people are looking for values in condominiums. They want to move downtown. You're seeing a shift where people want to live with their kids now. Not everybody wants to be on the Upper East Side. They want to go downtown. And now Hudson Yards, which is very new, super exciting. Somebody referred to it as Dubai on the Hudson.
Because it looks similar to some of the stores and some of the shopping centers in Dubai.
Right. I mean, it's exciting. And we won't know what's going to happen with the condos there for a while. It's going to take some time.
One big question that I have, and we just keep talking ad nauseum about the trade tensions and the ongoing skirmish between the U.S. and China and elsewhere. And I wonder about foreign investments. Are you still seeing that Chinese buyer, that European buyer, to come to the U.S.?
That buyer is gone. We haven't seen that buyer in a long time.
How long?
I would say it's been 3+ years since we've seen that buyer. I mean, typically in New York City, it's, you know, it's New Yorkers, it's very domestic. It's very light on, you know, international people coming to buy. I'd say it's probably 20%. People think that there's so many people that come here to buy, but really it's a lot of New Yorkers and a lot of domestic, you know, Texas, all over California, people buy here from within the United States. So that international, yeah, it no longer Chinese buyers are gone.
It's interesting because you see some of these crazy tall 200-story crazy buildings here in Midtown, just right by our office here on 57th Street, and then on the west, the western side. It's really interesting.
I'm wondering, you say there has been a softening, in particularly in New York City, and I'm wondering how big has the softening been, and how big could it be?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, we've seen probably a bit, it's probably down about 10% if I had to estimate. And I don't know. It's, you know, uncertainty is not good. All the stuff that's going on, like the trade wars, that kind of stuff is not good. It creates sort of instability in the market. But I, you know, I'm pretty optimistic about it. I see, you know, rates are good. People are still buying. So I think that, you know, the market's going to be steady. It has been steady, and I think it will continue to be so.
So, Bess, you're CEO of Brown Harris Stevens. What is your strategic focus for your firm this year, given what you're telling us about the real estate market in some of the key markets like the Hamptons and New York?
Well, we have kind of been focusing on hiring the right people. We just hired a new chief marketing officer. So we're really focusing on tightening up our markets and getting more strategic. We're focusing heavily on social media. That's obviously, as everybody knows, is like a new channel on the television. Everybody is on Instagram or LinkedIn or Facebook. And so we're spending a lot of time on digital. I think today print is kind of old school and people are not looking at it as much. And real estate used to always be like the glossy magazine and all the properties, but you get so many more readers or interests with content and social and digital. So we're focusing heavily on that. And Brown Harris Stevens, being a legacy firm, has typically been in print. And so now we're trying to flip it a little bit and do more digital.
I wonder if there are other benefits too from going digital, where you can actually measure who's viewing what, and then use that to be able to better market and understand what people are looking for.
100%. You hit the nail right on the head. I mean, you with print, you put stuff out there. Nobody knows if anybody even looks at it or if it goes in the garbage, but we can totally measure what people are opening up, and then we can get a little bit more info on that.
So what are you learning?
We're learning like what type of a person will like our information, who's interested in what, where do they live, what's their background. All that stuff is helpful to us so we can cater to our audience. So we're getting laser focused on digital. That's really important for us.
And it seems important given that the millennials are coming into their real estate buying part of their lives. Are you sensing any trends here, like in the New York, Hamptons, Florida market, about millennials and their purchasing intent?
You know, we see a lot of millennials purchasing in Brooklyn. I mean, that's very popular, you know, in downtown, and typically areas that are not popular yet. You know, they want to be in places where people are not there yet. So
they want to be, or that's where they can afford places.
That's, I think you said it a little bit better. I'm being very diplomatic. Well said. But yes, I think that's a big part of it. So.
Interesting. Bess Friedman, thank you so much for joining us. Bess is the CEO of Brown Harris Stevens, talking to us about the real estate market in New York.
Paul, I felt a certain magic as our next guest walked into our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studios. He is the longest serving malt master in the Scotch whiskey industry. He is David Stewart of the Balvenie. He is based normally in Scotland, the Balvenie, excuse me. He's normally based in Scotland, but he joins us here in New York. David, let's just talk about what it means to be a malt master.
Yes, it's a very unique job in the Scotch whisky industry. The Scotch whisky industry employs thousands of people, and really there's probably only 15 of us doing this same job throughout the whole industry. So we are actually involved in the quality of the whisky that's actually in the bottle, selecting the cask that will create any one of our different expressions, making sure our whisky tastes consistently and the quality is correct, and also innovating as well, looking forward on what we're going to release in a few years' time. So we're always innovating and experimenting in our warehouses and putting our whisky into different cask types and maybe changing the distillation process slightly to maybe give us something in the future. So it's I'm very proud to have worked in the Scotch whisky industry for so long and with this great family company.
So talk to us about the Scotch whisky business. Is it growing? Where is it growing? Where are people drinking Scotch more and less?
It is growing at the moment, and has been for the last 10 or 15 years. A number of the distilleries are actually increasing production. We need to look so far out. I mean, our youngest whiskey is 12 years, so we've got to forecast what we're going to sell in 12 years' time. So we've got to increase production at our distillery now. So we're putting whiskey into casks that will age on for the next 12 years. So we are increasing production at our distilleries, and that's happening throughout the industry. There's a lot of small craft distilleries being opened up in Scotland, probably another 10 or 15 that will be opened up in the next 5 or 10 years. So, and Asia probably is a big growing emerging market for the Scotch whisky industry.
You were talking about how long you've been doing this. You started in 1962 at the age of 17. You've been doing this a long time. What's been the biggest change in the industry?
Yeah, well, when I started, it was all about blended whisky. We single malts weren't around at that time. But our company, the family company of William Grant, launched Glenfiddich back in 1963, just a year after I started. And we probably had about 10 years, really, without any competition. And then the rest of the industry saw how well Glenfiddich was doing as a single malt, how profitable single malts can be. And then the rest of the industry came in to join us and launch their single malt. So I say blended whiskey is still the biggest category as far as sales are concerned, but single malts have got such a variety. As I've mentioned, there's 120 distilleries in Scotland, all producing different styles of whiskey, different flavours. So, and it's growing. To be fair, the last 10, 20 years, it's boom time for the Scottish whisky industry, and long may that continue.
Well, the Balvenie company, you're launching, I guess, a new product, a three-bottle set of whiskies. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this is the Balvenie Stories, which is all about how we created the whisky. We're calling it Stories because there's a lot of stories to tell about how the whiskies were created and the people behind the creation of these whiskies. So the first one is a 12-year-old whisky, which is called the Sweet Taste of American Oak. And this is we use the American charred barrels after bourbon, but in this instance, we've actually used virgin oak. Instead of charring them, we've only toasted them at a cooperage in Kentucky, and we've got these barrels sent over to Scotland. We gave them another toasting in Scotland, and then we put our 12-year-old Balvenie into these casks for a short finishing period. So it's added more oakiness and honey and citrus and vanilla notes to the whiskey.
Okay, so I should ask you about the increase in people investing in Scotch and sort of high-end bottles and all of that.
Yeah.
But I want to know more logistics about your tasting of this. Do you spit out the Scotch when you taste it, when you swish it around in your mouth, or do you drink it?
Well, it's not like the wine industry. We are trained nosers, so I'm nosing whiskey all the time. We've got tulip-shaped nosing glasses that have got a small opening at the top that we stick our nose into.
And so you don't actually taste it?
We don't taste it. Very rarely do we taste it. We may need to do 20 or 30 samples in a day from all different sides of the process. The new spirit, aging whiskey, finishes, single barrels. But no, we're nosing the whiskey. That's what takes a long training period.
Yeah. David Stewart, thank you so much for being with us, maltmaster of the Balvenie from Scotland here. We are looking at Boeing shares down more than 1%, but some people are expecting that they are getting ready to unroll the new 737, getting it back into service, 737 MAX. This, of course, was the one that came under a lot of scrutiny after being involved in two different crashes. Joining us to give us a sense of what the latest here is George Ferguson, Senior Aerospace Defense and Airlines Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. So, first of all, why is it important for Boeing to put the 737 MAX back in service?
Well, I mean, I think simply because they have no other product to offer to airlines, and a narrow-body airplane is the most prevalently flown airplane around the world. It's the biggest people mover. It's not to say that the 737 has problems and it shouldn't be offered. I think the airplane is fine. but you couldn't go to another, you couldn't decide you were going to redesign the 737 now because of these recent problems and have a product to offer people, you know, for another 5 years.
So, George, I know next month is the Paris Air Show, and among all the champagne and rosé that I'm sure you'll be drinking, can Boeing actually sell airplanes? Can they sell 737 MAXs next month in Paris?
The funny thing is we've seen them actually sell a couple in the last few months, even while the airplane's been grounded. So can they sell them? Yeah, bits and pieces, but there won't be any significant sales without getting this airplane back in the air and in revenue flight.
So it does look like they are going to get it back in air, but it's going to look a little different, right?
Yeah, so I mean, we'll have some modifications to it for sure, and I think that's what's going to get hammered out here. We have a global regulators meeting coming tomorrow, where the FAA is inviting in a bunch of regulators around the world, and my sense is the FAA is going to show them what they think the right fix is, and it seems to us that the fix is that this MCAS system that pushes the nose over in the event that the airplane's at risk of stalling, that this system will be less aggressive, because it really, the MCAS system in both crashes really aggressively pushed the airplane's nose down because it was getting erroneous sensor input. But the pilots couldn't counteract it purely by pulling back on the yoke of the airplane or the control wheel of the airplane. And it seems to me that sort of the fix will be not to let MCAS get that aggressive so the pilots can counteract it. There are other procedures for the pilots to fix what they call runaway stabilizer problem, but I think that will be core to the fix. I think the other challenge Boeing has here is they want the MAX to look like and take the same training as the 737NG, its predecessor. They sold it to airlines with the view that there wouldn't be much training required to transition from the old 737 to the new MAX. And so I think what we'll watch very closely as we go into this regulator negotiation is, will regulators want more training, especially if they'd want simulator training or actual flight training? I don't think flight training's on the table, but you never know. That costs airlines money, and they won't like that if they need that kind of training to transition pilots. Low-cost airlines hate additional costs, and so that'll be sort of key to watch as we get into this regulator round.
So, George, I know we're still kind of in the midst of this, or Boeing's still in the midst of this. Is there a sense of what the total cost or liability to Boeing will be here?
Yeah, so we've been plugging some numbers together over the last couple of days. And, you know, our view is that by the end of 3Q, the airplane will be back in the air. And we think that if they get into the air by the end of September, we think there's $1.5 billion worth of lost profit to the airlines that had deliveries before it was grounded or would have gotten deliveries over the last number of months. That number wouldn't sort of stop increasing because airlines would have until they got the deliveries they were expecting to continue to claim losses. We base that on Southwest, which is a very profitable airline. So we're trying to be a little bit high with that number, but we kind of see $1.4, $1.5 billion through the end of September, and we see about $1 billion cost of both of the crashes.
Got it. Very good. $1.4 billion. George Ferguson, senior aerospace analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us on the phone from Princeton, New Jersey. George, thanks so much for your comments on Boeing. It seems like, to the extent that Boeing may be past the worst of this, and as George suggested, if they can get the plane back in the air in the third quarter, they can put some kind of cap on the liability and move forward.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.